This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist. Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius. Live. Fit. Go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
And welcome to another episode of the How to Hunt Turkey podcast. On this episode, I've got Gerard Vandenbogaard with me, and he is a hunting guide out in Alberta. And this year, he ran a hunting lodge kind of thing in Ontario for turkeys. So I got him on here. We're going to be talking about turkey hunting. We're going to be talking about all the kinds of hunting we all kind of wish we could do, and his journey into being a guide in Ontario, and well, in Alberta and Ontario now, in a place where a lot of people don't think about there being a lot of hunters. I think that what you find when you actually spend some time in Canada, there are a lot of really good rural folks out there that love hunting and all that stuff. It's not just Toronto. I am wearing my Toronto, Ontario shirt today, represent for Canada. We can just pretend like the Toronto part isn't there, but if you haven't been to Canada, you don't understand why that's important. But anyways, Gerard, thank you so much for being on the podcast, man. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Pleasure.
Yeah, man. Pleasure is mine indeed. So did you grow up hunting, or did you come into it later in life? Just give me a little background on kind of your early hunting experiences. What were those like?
So I grew up in a farming family and had lots of encounters with wildlife in the outdoors. Always was an animal lover. Just anything to do with animals, wildlife especially, just loved it. Didn't actually really latch onto the hunting side of it until I was about 8, 9, maybe 10 years old. A good family friend of ours was a local fish and wildlife officer and really good at educating and bringing people into that space to show the value of conservation and that, you know, hunting is actually a beneficial thing, excuse me, for wildlife and for people. And so anyways, just having some good mentors, some good people to teach us, me and my siblings, the ropes was great. And, you know, I had a dad, it's Father's Day today. Happy Father's Day. I had a dad who really took the time to take us out there, and he enjoys hunting. It's probably not his number one passion in life, but his kids were. And so he took us all hunting, a lot, and made the time for that. And so, yeah, between those couple fellas, a dad taking us, giving us the freedom to do that. You know, we can get our license in Ontario when you're 12 years old. And I had been tagging along for probably 3 or 4 years before that. And then, yeah, once I hit 12, it was the addiction was on, and kind of never stopped from there. So,
yeah, I believe it, man. So what were some of your early hunts? What were you hunting for mostly?
So as a child, you know what, I think the first hunt I vividly remember was, I think I was 8 years old, and we tagged along. We were the golden retrievers for the group. And I want to say there was probably about 8 or 10 guys on a field spread for decoys. And that first hunt I got to tag along, we killed 52 geese. And I just remember being like, this is so cool. Me and my brother running out there, retrieving these birds and just like being that close to wildlife and stuff. That was probably, you know, one of the first memories that set the hook. I remember tagging along deer hunting different times and the older guys, you know, just making us feel included. And of course, having those close interactions with deer, you know, whether we're pushing them, jumping them out of their beds or tracking deer or, you know, and I enjoyed the whole processing side of it too, the skinning, gutting, processing. I've always kind of had a knack for that. And so, yeah, being able to get my hands into that just really kind of, again, set the hook for those later, well, I guess to where I am now. So,
yeah, absolutely. That sounds so different than how I grew up, because I've never even been waterfowl hunting because I just wasn't around it much. But I can imagine going out and having that sort of volume of excitement would be crazy. So you had mentioned like doing drives and stuff up there. I've noticed like most of the Canadians I talk to, and the reason I do talk to Canadians, I should probably explain this. My wife is from Canada, family friends of yours. So that's how, yeah, you know, we first met and started talking and stuff. But a lot of folks, especially the older folks, are like deer drive hunters mostly. Is it still like that, or do you see more of your like stand hunting these days?
You know, I think it's always been a very traditional cultural hunt, and you'll see that, you know, certainly in Canada and places, Saskatchewan is well known for it. And stateside, there's a lot of states where,
oh yeah,
running them with dogs or doing deer drives is very traditional. I would probably emphasize that portion of it, and I think it is a phenomenal way to hunt. But I would say that probably there has been for the younger generation, there's a greater shift towards a little bit more of this individual hunting, right? Where you go out independently, do your own scouting, put up your own stand. The trophy hunting mentality is being pushed, which it's not all right or wrong or otherwise. It just creates a very different culture than traditional deer drives would do. And you gain some aspects of the hunt, you also lose some of the camaraderie, but it's different. It's not all good or bad or otherwise. So
yeah, absolutely. I think so too. And you know, I think as you get older and as you learn more about these other styles, you start to understand, you know, pretty much all of it has its own merit for sure. So you did a bunch of geese hunting, you did whitetail hunting. When did you decide to become a guide, or did it just happen by accident one day?
Well, so I would say that kind of by default, I sort of had it in my blood where, you know, getting on board with hunting in the outdoors, and then just being so enthralled with it. And at the age of, 15, now I'm getting my own tags, filling my own tags. But once my tags were filled, it was like, man, like, what do I do now? I still need that fix, right? And yeah. So then I would take my brother hunting or my dad hunting or buddies hunting. And, without realizing it, I was being a guide. And so I think probably I was 16 years old, and I kind of took the reins for a local group of guys that they only had 3 or 4 guys left in their deer hunting group. And so I asked if I could kind of join them. And actually they said, hey, well, why don't you kind of, you know all the spots, you've got the areas staked out, we'll come and hunt, and why don't you kind of take the lead? And so at that point I sort of ran that deer hunting group, and as a 16-year-old kid, just didn't know a lot, but just loved it. And again, very informal guiding, so to speak, for the next 4 or 5 years. And then I came out west on a summer missions trip and saw the west and saw the wildlife and had a good friend there say, hey, you should actually seriously consider the career side of it. Reach out to some outfitters and see if there's work for you. Start as a pack hand or a wrangler, or just see if there's any work out there, Yeah. And then after a little bit of investigative work, I got a hold of Mike and it worked out. It just snowballed from there. So
yeah. And that's Mike's Outfitters. Is that the name of the place you work for in Alberta there?
Yeah. Mike's Outfitting in Alberta. Outfitting. Mikey Kranitz is his name. And he's definitely one of the best in the business for sure. Yeah. Runs a really good outfit, and I've been there since 2016. So
yeah, that's awesome. So what did you start out doing, and how did you kind of get, each of the rungs of the ladder, so to speak? What was the trajectory there? Cause man, I think everybody who loves the outdoors wants to think of a way to do more, be out there more. And you just don't hear about the behind the scenes of like, hey, you could literally just reach out to different guides and see if there's anything to do. Like, I would have never even thought of that when I was younger, unfortunately. So how did that kind of work once you did start working there?
Well, and so I was, I will say again, I can credit to the Lord's providence for sure. Because I sent out half a dozen emails. I was in university and I'm like, man, I just want to get in that industry. Just want to start figuring this out. And so I ended up sending a bunch of emails, just reaching out to different guys. And Mike, the timing of it, he was actually looking for a guide. And so he's like, hey, this kid's interested. Before I'd even put out an ad, he said, well, let's chat. Let's talk on the phone. Give me your resume, some references. Let's talk hunting. And basically his idea was, come for the spring bear hunt. So out here in the West, traditionally in the spring, you're going to have your bear hunt. It's not a whole lot going on in the summer unless you can find some fishing guiding. And then the fall, at least at Mike's Outfitting, we've got our early season archery for mule deer and for moose and for elk. And then it transitions to our rifle season where it's elk and moose. And then late season, we switch back to whitetails, mule deer, and wolves, coyotes, if that's something a guy's outfitting for. So anyways, there's a whole kind of season of work, but it does take a particular skill set. Not everybody's cut out for it. And so the bears is a really great place to start, where it is just a lot of grunt work, but a lot of like working a system. Can you stay organized? Can you keep your ducks in a row? Can you work hard? Can you do long hours? Can you deal with clients? Can you be professional? And yes, you got to know which baits to put guys at, and you got to be able to deal with skinning and gutting sometimes, and processing animals. So all these other side deals where it's like, that's a bit of a proving ground. And then the fall work. So that was like, hey, that's the test ground. And if you make it through the bear hunt, then we can talk about the fall. And then the fall hunts are a lot of the same skill sets, but now you actually need a bit of a hunter killer instinct, right? Like, can you get within 40 yards of a mule deer? Can you call in a bull elk? Like, and some of those skill sets are obviously developed, because I had never called in an elk or a moose until I started working for Mike. And he set up that opportunity for me. He said, hey, look, you know, I'll give you a client to work with. And he gave me all the instructions I needed, but I just didn't have the experience, right? So again, huge credit and thanks to Mike for creating that opportunity. And I was able to take a lot of the skills that I had learned in Ontario, chasing turkeys, chasing whitetails, how do animals react, right? Mm. And then translate that to, say, elk and moose, where you're, just some of the general principles, hunting downwind, knowing when to move and where to move. That's kind of how that all got applied.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, I bet that was some nerve-wracking stuff, those first few hunts out west, never having hunted, that kind of stuff. Like, did you go on your own hunts some first, or were you guiding clients the first time you went elk hunting?
You know, so the elk hunting, I'm trying to think. Yeah, elk, I was not thrown to the wolves. That's not a fair way to put it. But I had never hunted for elk before, and Mike gave me one bow hunting client. And it was like, hey, here's how you run a bugle. And I'd watched some YouTube videos and I'd practiced quite a bit. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'd gone scouting, so I knew where there was elk. And then it was basically a crash course of, hey, here's how elk interact and respond. And I'd watched some YouTube videos, but the only way you can do it is to do it.
Yeah.
Right. And the beauty of the West, and especially our area, there's a high density of elk. And so if you screw it up, on Monday, you don't want to screw it up intentionally, but if you happen to screw it up, get out there, keep hiking. You're going to find more elk. You're going to have more encounters. And if you hunt hard, you're going to learn from your mistakes pretty quickly and figure it out. Nice. So that ended up being, it was definitely nerve wracking. And it took that first year, the whole first year, I put a lot of pressure on myself trying to do well, but it was like, no, you just work hard and do your best. Yeah, that's all you can do, right?
So yeah, absolutely. It was a trial by fire for you. So did that first client end up getting an elk, or how'd that pan out?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think. Like, obviously, it was the bears in the spring first that really boosted my confidence. In the fall, that first elk hunting client, I'm trying to think, because I was just scouting the first 2 weeks, then I had a moose hunter. And that was pretty simple. We just dropped the moose hunter off on stand. So that was my first official big game guy, fall big game guiding. The elk client, that didn't work out. We got close to a couple elk, but didn't get close enough to make a shot happen. Okay. So that was a bummer. And then I had a break after that. And it wasn't actually, I killed myself an elk in October. Mike had a break in October. So I went and actually shot myself an elk, got the pressure, the dust off the barrel. And then, kind of from then on, I gutted some moose there later in the season and some deer. Nice. And so then I was like, okay, I can do this. But there was a lot of pressure that first 2 months where I'm like, man, I don't know if I can make this happen, you know?
Oh, I imagine. So. Yeah. And especially being a younger fella at that point, I'm sure there's just that passion to do well, and just none of the info in your brain of how to do well, seems like. And like as you're talking about it in hindsight, you're like, yeah, you just get out there and put in the work and it works out. But man, when you're a younger guy and you're trying to figure these things out, it's just like also confusing to you. At least it was for me. Like, I mean, I never have guided or anything that serious, but you know, we've always traveled and I've always tried to fish in different places and try to learn that and figure that out. And man, some of those first trips, you just like, you get so in the weeds about all these things you think are important. And now I look back and I'm like, man, if you just get out there and try some stuff, something to work out. Yeah. That comes with that confidence, you know? And I think that hunting is such a great way to build your self-confidence for sure.
There's so many benefits to hunting, and that's certainly one of them, right? Where you just get out there, put in the work, and it'll come full circle eventually. So
yeah, absolutely. And for all our listeners out there, I will turn the conversation to turkeys now. I just am so fascinated by all the stuff that you hunt up there, and I've just been wondering about this. So when did you first start turkey hunting? Was that back in Ontario when you were younger, or when was your first turkey hunt?
Yeah, so I actually, there was turkey hunting available already when I was 12 years old, but nobody I really knew did it a whole lot. It was kind of just becoming a thing. We had birds reintroduced because we didn't have, like a lot of places, even the States, there was not a very strong, well, the population had gone extinct up in Ontario.
Okay.
So they reintroduced birds, I believe in the late 80s. You'll have to fact check me on that. And so I was 15 years old when I started turkey hunting.
Okay.
And we actually had to take a special course in addition to your hunting license because it was a new thing. A lot of guys had never hunted turkeys and they really wanted to push the safety for it. And so I was 15 years old and again, totally green to it. But, you know, this local friend of ours from church, he had killed a turkey. We had gone to our other neighbor's place for turkey dinner. He had shot his first turkey. And so I'm like, man, this is cool. I got to figure this out. Burned a lot of time that first season and, managed to shoot a scruffy little Jake on probably my 10th day out. And, I was pumped and just super, you know, had so much to learn. I screwed up so many hunts, calling birds in, shooting at birds too far out, you know, moving at the wrong time. Didn't have a clue about roosting turkeys or any of that, or overcalling or even how to call. I just went out there and just started yakking at them. And actually, I should qualify that the year before I had went out with a friend of mine and he had bought a turkey license. And I actually attempted to guide him. I wasn't even old enough to hunt on my own yet. But I went with him and tried to call for him. And, you know, I knew where the birds were. So we went out there and tried to call these birds in and never did get him a turkey, but had some fun hunts. And eventually about 3 years later, I ended up calling a tom in for him and he killed it then. But, that was kind of my first initiation to turkeys. That was 10 days to kill my first bird. And then I hunted every day till the end of the season, calling in Jake's and could never get another one killed. Mm-hmm. And then the following year, the first 2 days I was tagged out. So,
hey, there you go. That reminds me a lot of my first turkey season. I hunted every day of the season and finally shot a Jake on the very last day. And that's when you really learn, when you're not tagging out and you're out there hunting and just grinding away. When you really learn. Like, you know, I shot a really nice buck a couple years ago on, I think, the third day of bow season. I didn't learn anything that year. I did not learn a thing. Yeah. I got a great buck. Yeah. And I mean, that is what you're after, but man, sometimes those struggle seasons are just the best.
Yeah. And again, in hindsight, right, where you can be really frustrated right in the middle of it, where it's like, oh my gosh, this is not working. Like, what's going on? And you can lose sleep over it. But again, in hindsight, you look back, or even that first year of my guiding, you know, I'll jump back to that for a second, where there was a lot of things I screwed up and did wrong. And I was so frustrated and burned out. But in hindsight, it's like, okay, the following year, I don't want to say I had a banner year. It took a few years until I had a banner year, but did so much better because you knew which mistakes were made and you knew how to improve it, right?
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, we appreciate all the slam dunks or when you call a bird in right off the roost and you know you're done and tagged out. But like you say, that's not always how you learn. And those probably aren't my most memorable hunts. The most memorable hunts are the ones where you have to work for it, right?
Oh yeah. The ones that almost worked out, the ones that just barely got away. That's what keeps me awake at night, man. It's that fish I didn't quite catch, or that deer that I saw and then moved in on him and he never showed up again. And why did that happen? Or that turkey that I called to and then he went the other way. And, you know, all those things, they add to it. So from that first season, does anything come to mind, like when you think about things you've learned about turkey season, like any of those lessons from that first season that have really stuck with you?
Oh yeah. And it's in not just that first season, but there's always this culmination of all the mistakes I've ever made in my life hunting. And it's kind of becomes this like reel of whenever I'm doing any kind of other hunt or coaching somebody else, it's like, these are the things, do not do these things.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple simple ones are like, know your equipment, right? I was just using an old 870 with a modified choke and 2 3/4 inch load, which is great. It'll kill a turkey, but I had not patterned that gun. And, you know, it was probably good for about 28 to 30 yards top end. And then that pattern, that spread was just too open. And so, I shot and missed a bird at it's about 38 yards. And I couldn't believe it. Couldn't figure out what happened. And then I went back later on after the season. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess that probably wouldn't have worked so well. You know, stupid, simple mistake.
Yeah.
But know your equipment, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, man. I did a kind of similar thing. First bird I shot was really close. And then a couple of years later, I missed a few birds just shooting farther than I had any business shooting. And I never did pattern that gun because the first bird I shot, I just absolutely laid him out, you know? So why would you need to? And I got a new shotgun a couple years ago. And that's the first thing I did. I went out and I was like, all right, what is this gun do at 40 yards? And I shot it and I knew. And now I know. Okay. Yep. And I've not shot a bird past even 30 yards with it. Because I just, it's like, for me, when I'm turkey hunting, I either win big or I lose big. Like, I don't hardly ever have a just barely get, it's like they're either 20 yards or they're not even close. So that's definitely a thing. So yeah, man, knowing your gear, that is a huge thing for sure. So there in Ontario, what are your kind of like calling, like go-to things that you try to do when you're calling? I wonder if it's much different than, you know, what I hear a lot of people talk about around here. What's your kind of go-to calling sequence depending on, you know, situations, of course?
Well, I'll probably actually just qualify that, throw a little disclaimer and say that calling is just an accessory to the overall hunting package. So, so I'll jump to my calling package in a minute, but I mean, for me, calling is just 10% or 20% of the whole gamut of what I'm using to kill birds. And I think that when I started turkey hunting, it was like, I've got to be able to call like the best of them. I got to be able to like lure this turkey in from wherever he is and make it work. And calling is important, but I've actually in the last couple of years killed a lot of birds without even calling at all. Mm-hmm. So that's just a disclaimer where, anybody out there that thinks that, you know, you got to be able to master a mouth call, you got to, I mean, those are important things. They're helpful things, but it's not the be all end all. So typically what I mean, in a regular day of turkey season back in Ontario, 9 times out of 10, I really try to roost birds the night before. That just makes it so much easier the next morning, when you know where there's birds, right? It doesn't always pan out the way you want it to, but it's like, at least you're in that vicinity. And then I'll just set up decoys or no decoys either way, but I'll set up within, you know, 100 yards of that roost if I can. That way you're right in that zone, right in that proximity of where they're at. And then, you know, the classic couple tree yelps. Usually in our, I don't know about out there, but for us, the toms usually fly down first and they're sometimes on the ground for 10, 15 minutes before the hens actually pitch out, really? Depending on the setup and the scenario.
That's not the way it is here.
I've noticed that a lot this year. I mean, sometimes if the whole flock is roosted together, that's a different story, but the tom's on his own. He'll be down way early trying to sucker those hens and coax them in even before they're out of the tree. But anyways, some tree yelps and then just your standard. I always try to start quiet and then build the bird up. Right. And if he's quiet, I'm not going to try. I mean, I might try once or twice to see if I can get him fired up, but otherwise I try to avoid even calling. And my calling is not phenomenal. It's not that great, but I'll just sort of like, whatever that bird is dictating is kind of how aggressive I'll play with it. You know, whether it's a hen or a tom, if he's with hens and I'm trying to call in the hens, the same deal. If she's aggressive and sassy, you know, then I'll work her up to that kind of level of getting her fired up. But yeah, I don't see a benefit in being loud and aggressive all the time. And especially if birds are call shy or been hunted before, then it's counterproductive. So
absolutely, man. I think that's so good what you're saying about you got to turkey hunt first and then you call them in. You're not like a turkey caller, you're a turkey hunter, right? And I think, I don't know if you've ever read the book 10th Legion by Tom Kelly, but he's got a part in there where he talks about, I think he equates turkey calling to, I'm not sure, I think he gives it 30% of turkey. Yep. And like 70% of it has nothing to do with your calling. So you're in good company with the whole, you ought to be hunting, you know, 70 to 80% of it is hunt. And then the rest is calling. And I think that's so important too, because I know that myself, especially in the early years, I would get so frustrated because you see the videos, right? The videos, they only show you the videos where they come into calling, and you're like, so am I like completely just the dumbest person ever? Because they are all calling in these birds from 300 yards away. I've never seen that happen, you know? And what didn't help matters either is like, sometimes my dad would come out hunting with me and he would lay out 5 or 6 yelps, and all of a sudden these birds would come in from forever away. And I think really that had more to do with the day than really the calling. And I think that sometimes you can really major on the minors, right? You can get so focused on the perfect call that you forget all the other parts of hunting. And it's all good, right? The better you are at calling, the better you're going to probably be at turkey hunting. And it's all beneficial, right? But you got to kind of get it in the right order, I think. So let's dive in a little bit on that other 70 to 80%. So you were saying you try to always roost them, makes it a lot more doable. You try to get within 100 yards, start soft, you work them up. What are some other things that you do when you're turkey hunting to get you in the game that don't have to do with calling? Like, say you don't have one roosted or the roost play doesn't work out. What's your next step?
So again, a bit of a qualifier will depend on how badly do I want to kill a bird, and how badly do I want to hunt a bird?
So, okay.
And the reason I say that is if I'm trying to kill a bird, I want to find a bird that's hot. I want to find a bird that's in the mood. And you and I both know that you can go to the same spot 2 mornings in a row and the birds are there, and one day they're fired up.
Yep.
And one day they are tight-lipped, or they're just not in the mood. Right. And I can't explain it. I'm not, whether it's weather or like pressure or atmospheric pressure or whatever, I don't know all those things. But it's really difficult to work on birds that aren't in the mood.
Yeah.
And especially, again, my calling is not phenomenal. And so I know guys that can talk to birds and work them up, and I don't have that skill set yet. So typically what I do, to be honest, is if I want to kill a bird, I want to find a bird that's hot. And so if I set up in the morning and in that first hour, the birds are tight-lipped, they pitch down, they do their thing, they're henned up, I don't hang around. I go find something else that's working, something else that's talking. And usually that means hiking over to a different piece of property. I'll even jump in the pickup. I got lots of access in Ontario where I'll go for a cruise and I'll go find birds. You know, and I've got all these back pocket places saved. So sometimes I'll just park the truck, hike back in there. Sometimes I'll just scout from the road and, okay, there's that flock of birds. Let's get around. Let's get behind them. Let's give them a try. So that's, if I'm in the mood to kill birds, that's what I'm trying to do. Just get aggressive, but only with birds that are susceptible to that. If there's a smart old Tom that has evaded me, and there's usually a couple on my list where it's like, okay, I really want to hunt this bird. And usually I'll try to save those birds for, you know, myself, where it's like, I don't have to kill today. I don't have to kill tomorrow. I can run the season out. I'd rather have a good chase.
Yeah.
You know, for a newer hunter that can burn them out.
Yeah.
Or if you're guiding clients, that can burn them out. But for myself, I'd rather chase those birds. When you play that cat and mouse game and it works out, then it's great. So anyway, on those birds, if they fly down and get henned up, those are birds I'll wait on. Those are birds that I'll, and they're there. I've found that birds don't actually usually go a lot farther once they shut up than you think. I used to think, oh yeah, you know, they pitch down, you're calling at them, they're gobbling, and then they get henned up, they're quiet, and you're like, oh shoot, they're gone. They buggered off, you know, and if you just sit and wait, I can't tell you how many times, you know, an old bird will come looking back for your calling once he ditches the hens, or they'll hang out in that brush for, because I start the day often with field edge setups, and mid-morning, late morning, that's when they'll pop their heads out of the trees. So if you want a smart bird, patience is going to be your number one thing, right?
Yeah.
And then as far as a couple other simple tactics is, if you've watched birds or pattern birds, just get in front of them. It's much more difficult to call or decoy a bird back from where they've come from.
Yeah.
But if you get in front of them, sometimes I don't even call or decoy. I'll just sit and wait. Mm. And if they're coming back down that fence line, you're golden.
Yeah. I like it, man. Just use your positioning to your advantage. I think, man, you just got my head spinning with just thoughts of just these birds that I've chased before that were tricky. And man, I'm like you. I love the chase of the one that's a little extra sneaky and a little bit harder to get at. And
yeah,
there's definitely a lot to that. And I love what you said too about whether you're in the mood to hunt one or whether you're in the mood to kill one. I think I spend a lot of turkey season not realizing that I'm not actually in the mood to kill one and I want to hunt them. And I'll go home and kind of beat myself up and be like, man, what was I thinking? And, you know, I come to realize like, well, what I was thinking is I wanted to go look in this creek and see if there was a 4-foot long nose gar there. And I wanted to look for mushrooms over here under this tree. And I wanted to see if there were any turkeys out in this field today. And, you know, there's days where you're really locked in and there's days when you're just enjoying it. Right. So I think that, it's important to know which one you're actually going for, because I think that it's really easy to put other people's ideals on your own hunt. And I sometimes when I'm taking other people, I forget to figure out where they're at. You know, like, oh, hey, is this the kind of person that wants like the one that got away? Or is this the kind of person that wants immediate gratitude? And if so, I might just leave them at the house. But that's not really an option you probably have guiding clients, right? So is this your first year doing like a turkey camp sort of a situation there in Ontario?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So my new and upcoming business is called East to West Outfitting for obvious reasons. And yeah, this spring was the first year I took turkey clients in Ontario. And so we had some great hunts. We killed a bunch of birds. And typically when I'm guiding clients, it's going to be something where it's like, hey, we're trying to kill birds. And so there's no such thing as a slam dunk guaranteed hunt, but I want to do my best to get guys on birds that we can actually kill. We can always take the rest of the day and watch birds, get out there and listen and enjoy the rest of the world, but if there's a smart old bird I've been trying to kill for 2 years or whatever, I don't want to burn a whole day just watching a fence line with a guy that's in there for some action. Right
absolutely,
because he only has a 2 or 3 day window to make it happen. So yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. So obviously you're putting in the work, you're scouting, you've got your spots, you've got, you know, however that works, you got your place to hunt, but there is a big unknown that you can't control. And that is the client, right? So if someone's going on a guided turkey hunt, whether it's with you or with anyone else, what's like the number one thing they need to get locked down? Like, what's the thing that always ends up frustrating you? Like, man, here we are again. They've done this thing. What's that thing?
I've gotten, and I don't say this, I say this carefully. I've been able to reduce a lot of those variables by having a bit of a system ahead of time, which I've learned from Mike. And that kind of boils down to eliminating those things before you head out, or at least knowing what a guy is capable of before you head out. So something simple like pattern and shotgun.
Yeah.
A lot of guys are like, oh, you know, I know how to shoot a shotgun, whatever. And especially guys that have never shot or shot at turkeys. Just the whole thing of, okay, we're going to actually go out and, you know, believe it or not, I didn't do it for a guy this year. And we had some of the following issues, but set up on a stump, put your target out there 40 yards, take a shot, you know, or at 20 yards and 40 yards. And I'll actually sometimes just use target load, so you don't blow somebody's shoulder off. And say, okay, look, I want you to visualize what this pattern is doing. You know, at 10 yards, you know, you're talking a shot pattern this big. So actually it's easier to miss a turkey that's too close.
Yeah.
Which guys don't believe, and then it happens and they realize it. And then also, you know, 40 yards, this is what we're talking about. Something simple like aim for the base of that neck. Don't aim for the head. I can't tell you how many birds I've actually missed by, you know, you just up and shoot at the head and all of a sudden it's like, what? I know better. Right. So knowing a guy's equipment, knowing what they're capable of, and like we talked about it a little bit before, but what is the guy's expectations? So we have some guys that just can't hike or walk. And that's not just turkey hunting, that's out west too. But if a guy is not able to put on the miles, and you burn him out putting on the miles, he's not going to enjoy his time, probably still not going to kill a bird. You've got to figure out a way to get a bird in front of him where he can actually get to it. Right. And so, yeah, kind of reading your client ahead of time and knowing what his limitations and expectations are. You know, also educating them on turkey hunting as far as movement, right? A guy that's never hunted turkeys before, they don't get that you cannot move. So two things to mitigate that then, you know, one, you preach at them and say, hey, look, like this is very serious. You cannot move or those birds are not going to come into range. Or two, you know, for a guy that's fidgety and doesn't get it, we hunt out of a blind, right? And that's just going to be something we've got to use to make sure that we get a chance to actually kill some of these birds. You know, and some of those things are things you learn as you go. There's no magic bullet, but those have been a couple simple, helpful things where, just to help increase the odds, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of answered my next question in this question, because I was going to ask you, what's the mistake you see most common? And I had a feeling it would probably be the fidgety, you know, just not understanding there's a time to move and a time not to move. And mostly it's that there's a time not to move. So, man, I don't know how many times. I mean, I relearned that lesson this year even. I, you know, thought I was in a good hide one day, and all of a sudden this bird comes in and he gets to 100 yards, and then he gets real interested in crossing the creek and not being around me anymore when he was coming in on a string. And I thought, that's interesting. And I kind of looked around and I thought, well, it's not that interesting. It's just that I did not have a good hide and I was moving too much. But that can definitely be a thing for sure. So that's really interesting too. I think a lot of people could learn a lot about self-auditing, you know, just, okay, is it that a lot of times they're seeing me, you know, people sometimes lack the little bit of self-awareness that you would be able to have, like that objective view of like, hey man, you know, I do this every day. I noticed you can't hold still, you know, and that was something I really had a big advantage of hunting with my dad sometimes is that I think that's all he ever said to me until I turned like 20. It's just like, you've got to hold still. You got to hold still and you got to keep your lure in the water. Those are the two things he was always telling me. Stop moving around. I like that a lot, man. So,
For sure.
So what was your turkey season like this year? How many folks did you take out? How did it kind of play out for you?
So formally, I just ended up taking 600. So I kind of started this all up in March, and I'm like, okay, I want to get some guys. I want to make this happen. Ended up just taking six guys from the West, and they come out, and we had a hoot. We had a really good time. So I'm just doing three-day hunts because you can kill two birds in Ontario. And so I wanted to just give everybody the chance to kill both those birds because you're going to only shoot one bird a day. And I figured, you know, if you throw in a day of bad weather or somebody misses a bird or something like that, I want to have 3 days for guys to get the full experience, and kill their birds. And that way I can do, you know, kind of, I'm hoping for a bit of a higher end, catered hunt where it's like, hey, we're focusing on you to get your birds in. Anyways. All that to say, we had, those six guys come and we killed, we tagged four guys out. Four birds for the first two guys, two birds for the next husband-wife team, and then two birds for the next group, and so of two guys. And so everybody got shooting at birds. The last group, one fella, he missed two birds, and hopefully he comes back to redeem himself. and then, of course, on the side, I guide friends and family and just, you know, for fun, take my dad out hunting. We killed a couple great toms and tried to get my sister a bird. That didn't work out. She had to get one on her own without Guy Gerard. So she, Mariella did great on her own and killed a bird. And then, you know, my brother got his first archery bird, which was awesome. That's something I've not even done myself. So yeah, I had just a lot of great memories of spring. Probably the highlight was, my brother, the day he got married, Derek, we took him out for a little bachelor party the morning of his wedding. And, we went and he killed a bird, and we got some great pictures all dolled up in our groomsman attire. So yes, yeah, just a fun, fun hunt.
I love that picture. I remember seeing it and I was just like, this is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
It's, man, that's the way to do it. So book your wedding in Ontario around turkey season and book a turkey hunt right at the same time.
You betcha.
So
bonus.
I want to dive in a little bit about this archery hunt because I've never archery hunted turkeys before, and I've talked to a few people that have. We don't have like a archery season here in Missouri, so there's not really any incentive for me to get out there with a bow when I already struggle enough, right? But it's something that I might end up doing next year. I'm wanting to do some traveling and stuff and kind of expand my season a bit. So when you're archery hunting, was this a blind situation or did you just kind of run and gun with the bow? What did you guys do?
Yeah, so no, it was a blind situation. I mean, I'll be honest again, I've never killed a bird myself with a bow. And so I've talked to lots of guys that have and do it successfully. So actually me and my brother, we had talked about maybe doing that this year, and he's recently taken up archery. And so he's like, he was committed to it. He was going to kill a bird with a bow. And I was less committed, but I did bring my bow along. And anyways, long story short, we didn't roost some birds. It was probably one of the only times this morning we went out blind, or this season we went out blind. We hadn't roosted birds the night before. And so we heard a bird and got in there, and he was close enough to the blind we had set up there that like, we can probably make this work. So we sat and called, and we actually had a tom come in from the other way behind us. But before that, actually we had a Jake come slipping in the side door and just hung out front, had the decoys close, which hunting out of a blind, most archery guys I've heard say, you know, keep your decoys close rather than further out. You want a close shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a bit of a rodeo, but he ended up shooting that bird, and we did recover him. He made it quite a ways on us, but we were able to recover him, and yeah, it was a fun morning. So
I bet. So what do you use for a broadhead there? Are you using a big expandable or what are you using?
You know, we're just using, and again, I say we, but he was just using his regular whitetail setup.
Okay.
And again, a lot of guys I've talked to lately, avid bow hunters have said, you know what? Yeah, a big expandable is going to be good. It's going to be helpful. But if you're comfortable and you're shooting your regular setup and you're dialed in, it's, again, shot placement. You know, you can't screw up and hope that a big broadhead is going to save your day.
That's right.
And I think, and I would just take that a step further, again, having not killed them with a bow, but I do know that shot placement on turkeys is incredibly important with a bow, because, you know, that front third of them is just a basketball size of breast meat where there's a lot of bird there to hit and it's not going to kill them.
Right.
You know, so that's probably something I would preach without, again, having done it myself, but I just know how important shot placement is.
Yeah.
More than what broadhead you're using.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense, man. Just put it in the right spot and it doesn't matter as much on what you're using for a broadhead. So, and the decoy's close. I like it, man. I like it a lot. I got a buddy who hunts out in Kansas, and him and a buddy of his doubled on birds. His buddy with a bow and then him with the shotgun. And they ended up, it was a crazy story. And I just thought, man, that would be an interesting combo. One guy with a bow and the other with a shotgun. But, yeah. So when you're out there and you're in the heat of guiding season and you're roosting birds every night, and you're obviously getting up to do the roost play every morning, how are you staying alive?
Yeah, no, I mean, part of it is just the passion for it that fuels it, you know, like I can jump back to the bear season we've had the last 3 weeks here, where it's like, it's a grind. There's a lot of hours that go into it and a lot of late nights, early mornings, but you got to do it because you love it. You know, if you're hating yourself every morning you wake up and not enjoying it, well, it might be arguable that it's not actually something you really need or want to do, right? There's got to be this deep down inside, you got to have a love for it.
Yeah.
As with anything in life, that's going to be what rides you through. And as far as, yeah, you do have to carve out time to take a nap in the middle of the day. If I'm guiding guys for birds and it's like noon, and you know, usually they get wore out before I do, but I get to a point sometimes where it's like, guys, you know what? I'm tapping out. you guys go read a book or check your phone or whatever you want to do, but I need a nap. I'm going to take an hour break. And I don't feel guilty doing that anymore. I used to be like, oh man, you know, I'm paid to be hunting right now. But, if you want to be a good hunter, you got to be able to rest as well. Contrary to, you know, there's an importance to be grinding and to be hustling. But you also got to be rested enough to hustle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you get used to it the more that you do it. And sometimes all you need is just a little midday nap and it'll fix you. Yep. But I definitely noticed that a lot of times where I've been trying this year to not run on way too little sleep for 2 days in a row. I find that a lot of times that first day is free. You know, you can run on really bad sleep once. And if you can recover the next day, then you can do it again if you need to. And that's kind of been my rule, and it really served me well this year. I kind of went into turkey season feeling like I was letting myself down, but not really, you know, getting out there. But then I ended up tagging out faster than I ever have, and I kept my brain while doing it. So I think there's something to that. You know, you got to know when to rest and when to really get after it, and a nap will save your life, man. I think it's really important to remember that. So you were mentioning bear hunting, and I just have to talk to you about this gigantic bear that you shot a few years ago. So like you guys, you bait bears out there out west, right? That's kind of the way that works. So let's see, did you get your bear in the fall or the spring season?
No, it's a spring season here for bears. And, that was 2021, I guess I killed him. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it's been back a while, and I remember when you posted about it, I remember looking at it and thinking, like, this doesn't even look like a bear. It's so large. It's, like, got to be something else. But tell me just a little bit about that. How did that deal kind of play out and stuff? And I just want to hear about that because, you know, springtime, I'm always just thinking about turkeys, but I have in the back of my brain, there are also bears that one could hunt. And so what's it like doing like a bear hunt in contrast to a turkey hunt, right? I mean, obviously probably not as vocal, but what's that like? What was that hunt like?
Yeah, I mean, again, as a bit of a disclaimer, I mean, they're two very different hunts, and that's part of the reason I've chosen and decided to keep doing the turkey hunts in Ontario is because there's a lot of contrast between the two, and I love them both.
Yeah.
Didn't want to give either one up, so we're doing them both. Yeah. The bear hunt is very different in that it's a lot of work up front baiting bears. But when it comes to the actual hunt, you get there and you sit and you wait and you wait and you sit. And it's a little bit actually more mentally demanding than it is physically exerting, as sometimes turkey hunting, if you want it to be that way, it can be that way, but you're not interacting with the bears per se. You're sitting and you're waiting, right? You put out your variety of bait, which is important. In the case of this big bear I killed, again, credit to Mike Ukrainitz for giving me the chance to run and to hunt a bait on the side, and spent a lot of time baiting that spot. And anyways, this bear, I'd known he existed, and I hunted for him probably. I didn't really hunt for him until actually 2021, because the year before I knew he was big, but he was kind of rubbed up still. He was missing fur on his shoulders, along his back. Just that's something bears do out here, especially if they're younger bears. They'll rub on the trees and they'll actually rub out patches of fur. So as a bear gets to be more mature, then they don't do that anymore. And so anyways, 2020, he was a large bear. I actually passed on him a number of times, not realizing he was actually as big as he was. And then probably COVID saved his life. There's a lot of guys out hunting, but with COVID, not so many outfitter bear hunts. So, you know, even that Mike's, who didn't take as many guys bear hunting. So in Alberta, and I guess Canada in general, there wasn't a lot of American hunters. And so there was a pile of Boone and Crockett bears that came in 2021 after COVID had kind of passed through. I had known that bear existed. 2021, there he is again. He looked pretty good. I thought, you know what, if I can kill him, I'm going to try to kill him. First night I hunted, because, again, I'm guiding in between, and then we can't hunt and guide on the same days. So Sunday nights are kind of our only time to get out and hunt, unless we tag hunters out earlier. So I hunted Sunday night, the first chance I had. I had pictures of him. He was on the bait. So I hunted Sunday night. He came in right at dark, too late to shoot. I mean, I could have squeezed off a shot, but wouldn't have been ethical. So I just let him go. He fed, wandered off in the dark, and then I slipped out of there. And it was about a week and a half later, I had the chance to hunt him again. No bear showed up. And then a couple days later, I had hunters tagged out. So I sat again. And he came in at 10 o'clock. And I drew on him about five different times, but just didn't have a perfect shot. So I let back down. And then finally, right at dark, he gave me a perfect broadside shot. Wow. And took it. And he ran 30 yards. And that was that.
Wow.
Still didn't believe he was that big. My buddy Alec helped me recover him the next morning. And we were just fighting to get him on the quad. Wheeled him out of there. Knew he was giant, just didn't know how giant he was, and threw him on the scale, and actually thought the scale was maybe broken because we've never weighed a bear that big, and ended up getting the neighbor's digital scale, and it's like, okay, he is actually that big. So
wow. Yeah, so what did you end up weighing?
So he was 515 pounds spring weight, and then he had a Booner skull, 21 and 4, 16 skull, and then I think he squared 7'6".
Holy
is what
cow.
He squared. So just a monster of monsters, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Very, very cool.
Yeah. So what's it like knowing you had a bear of that caliber in your bait, and then you're going to try and slip out at dark, knowing that bear is alive and well the night you didn't get to shoot him? Do you get the – I mean, because – we do have bears in Missouri now, and we just had our first bear season a couple years ago for black bear. And so technically they're here, but there's none in my county for sure. So I never think about it. Like, the only thing we've got is coyotes and bobcats. And so I walk around deer season, whatever, unbothered. And I know black bears are not as aggressive as like grizzly bears. But, like, what's it like knowing there's a bear like that in your vicinity when you're walking home in the dark?
You know, so I tell guys all the time, and you don't want to Steve Irwin it. You don't want to, like, make it off that it's not a big deal. But I always tell guys, bears are like big raccoons. You know, they're slave to their stomachs. They're curious. They're very tolerant of human activity. And so, but they're mostly scared of you. You just don't want to be stuck in some back alley and have them cornered, just like you wouldn't a raccoon. And so that's kind of what factors into it. And yes, you want to be wise. You want to be giving their space and stuff. But for the most part, they're actually quite scared of you. And if you give them their space, they're just going to do their thing and you can do theirs. So, or they can do theirs. So when I slipped out of there, that bear walked off the bait site, and you know, I slipped out the back door and I'm heading the other way, and I've got a quad parked there 200 yards away. And so, there's a respect feature involved there, but I'm not scared of bears for sure.
Right. Well, it wouldn't,
but again,
really
that's
work.
Come with time and knowing their behavior a little bit. And yeah, I try not to be foolish about it, but
It wouldn't really work to be a bear hunting guide who's scared of bears, I don't guess.
No.
Yeah. It's funny. So like earlier this year, I got to spend some time down in Louisiana with a buddy of mine, and we did a lot of fishing and a lot of nighttime fishing. And, you know, I just have in my brain that there are alligators, and my brother-in-law is there with me, and he's like, not that interested in encountering an alligator. And I, the whole time I was like, man, I want to see him. I want to see him close. I want to see a 10-foot, you know, all this stuff. Well, one point we're trolling down this weedy edge down there after dark. And all I have is just like a light on my bow fishing bow. We were bow fishing, and we kind of cut back up into this little stream. And all of a sudden I realize I am surrounded by like 6-foot tall grass in this water. And it's like inches away from the boat on both sides. And I thought, how would you like to see a 10-foot gator right now? And all of a sudden it seemed very different to me, this idea. So, you know, it's, you definitely have to like mentally get yourself in the right spot. Like I had a thing happen one night I was talking to Caroline, my wife, about deer hunting and hearing the coyotes and how I love to hear them howl. And she was like, doesn't that scare you? And I was like, no, I'm not scared of coyotes. Coyotes are scared of me. You know, that's just how that works. They're not going to come attack me unless they're rabid or something. Well, the next morning I'm coming in at dark and I'm hearing them howling from basically right below the tree I'm going to get in. And I thought, well, let's see if I actually believe that or not. And sure enough, I went on out there and it was no big deal because, I mean, you know, you hear about the fluke deal on the news or whatever, and then you think that's just what happens every time, but I imagine it's just not quite as frequent as one would believe on those things.
Yeah. No, it's, again, it's something where, like, I tell guys, I'm more scared of snakes than I would ever be of bears. And I think part of it is just, you know, your comfort zone, what you grew up with. And
right,
probably people in the South deal with snakes a lot more. And they're like, yeah, no, snakes are no big deal. You just give them their space. And
yep,
same as I'm saying with bears, right? So,
right, absolutely.
Yeah, it's also cultural for sure, right? Where you grew up reading stories about bears and everybody's scared of bears because they're big, bad bears. But in reality, again, it's such a small percentage of, again, you got to show them respect, give them their space. But such a small percentage of bears and human encounters that actually exist. Well, they do exist. You just got to be mindful of that. So,
yeah, absolutely. I put in for our bear hunt this year, and when you do a little research, there's a zone down here that has like the most bear sightings, but it also has Lake of the Ozarks, which has just tourists galore. And so you kind of look at that and you go, okay, most bear sightings, but also most tourists. So are the most bears there or not?
Exactly. You got to do some research and some analysis on that for sure.
Yeah, I think that's something, you know, the older I get and the more I hunt and the more I fish, the more you take people's ideas of things and you kind of look at them a little bit differently. You know, someone will say, oh yeah, we've got hundreds of turkeys. And then you start to say, okay, what month do you have hundreds of turkeys? And December, when we've got our corn out. And I'm like, okay, all right. No, I don't think I need to come hunt on your place. That's fine. Because, you know, it's all, you got to know how to diffuse the information, right?
Sure. Perspective, right? So.
Absolutely. So, man, thanks for being on this podcast. I really appreciate it. We'll kind of wrap up here, but I would love for you to tell people where they can find you and all the different things that you're doing.
Yeah, well, I'm still figuring a lot of that out myself. So okay. I'll have hopefully a website here jumping online in the next month or so, if it all works out. I'm on Instagram, Guide Gerard, Guide_Gerard is my handle. And then, of course, Facebook, just Gerard Van den Bogaard. And yeah, I'm there. I will be more prevalent online, hopefully, once I get things rocking with that website, especially. And I hope to actually on my website share kind of an updated album. Every half a year, my plan is actually to share an updated album of kind of how our hunts progress. Down the road, I'll probably hope to eventually be out on my own, but you know, January to June, have kind of an album of all the hunts we do, from winter wolf hunts to spring turkey, and then transitioning, ending off with the bear hunts that we're just finishing up right now. Then we take a little summer break, and then July through to December, you know, the second half of the season, just an update and pictures and an album, just kind of with the storyline of what happened that year, that season. Awesome. And I hope to share that online as well, just kind of as an ongoing journal, as it were. So
yeah, awesome. Yeah, absolutely, guys, get out there and follow Guide_Gerard on Instagram, or friend him on Facebook. He's one of my favorite follows on Instagram. If you like seeing big whitetails, if you like seeing big mule deer, if you like seeing moose or elk or turkeys, just any of that stuff. Or I mean, you do you still run a trap line, or have you?
Yeah, in Alberta now. Yep. So, and I'll tag along with my sister. She's got a trap line in Ontario.
Yeah.
And so I snare in Alberta, and then I'll tag out with my sister, and she does a bit of trapping in Ontario. So
yeah. So if you just like seeing pictures of critters, it's a great follow, if nothing else. But if you're thinking of going up there and getting a guided trip, I would look no further than this fella right here. So thank you guys so much for listening. If you can leave this podcast a 5-star review, that really helps me out. You can find me on social media, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and I also have a Gmail account. It's howtohuntturkey@gmail.com. So shoot me an email if you got any questions or comments. But anyways, thank you guys so much for listening, and take somebody hunting with you.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.